The Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie opens its doors to a new Take a Stand Center on Sunday. The exhibition includes 3D technology that shares the stories of brave survivors like Fritzy Fritzhall as holograms.
The holography that I have done is in memory of my mother, my brothers, my extended family, the 6 million that cannot speak for themselves and others, the 1.5 million babies that they gassed. In my mind, I was doing it for those people so that their stories can live.
That's Holocaust survivor and Illinois resident Fritzy Fritzhall. She shares her story later on in the hour. Plus, as the Halloween holiday approaches, we've got a unique take on celebrations for dogs. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. The latest news is next. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center in Skokie will unveil its Take a Stand Center on Sunday. It's a new multi-million dollar immersive exhibition that's been in the works for about 3 years. The Take a Stand Center was created to focus on social justice issues and, according to the Illinois Holocaust Museum, move visitors from knowledge to inspiration to action. In total, there are 3 new galleries and roughly 4,000 feet of added floor space. At the heart of the Take a Stand Center, though, is the Abe and Ida Cooper Survivor Stories Experience, which uses groundbreaking 3D technology to tell the stories of 13 people who lived through the Holocaust, including several from the Chicago area. Conceptually, this is an effort to move the museum's archive into the 21st century. Holographic interview recordings let visitors come face to face with the survivors in a lifelike way, and the voice recognition technology gives museum guests the power to interact and actually ask important questions. We're going to hear more from one of those survivors, who's a Chicago area resident, later in the program. But first, I want to welcome Susan Abrams. She's the CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum and on the line from Skokie to tell us more about this new Take a Stand Center. Hi, Susan. Welcome to the 21st.
Thank you. Glad to be chatting with you.
You know, when we're learning about this, it seems like such an amazing experience, especially the ability to have a digital interaction with Holocaust survivors. How did you first come up with this whole idea?
That's a great question. We had been grappling with how will we tell survivor stories in the most compelling ways for generations to come. As you know, most survivors are in their 80s and 90s now, and it is one of the great benefits of coming to our museum that all of our student and educator groups and many of our public visitors, too, have that opportunity to not only tour our world-class exhibitions and attend our programs, but also to hear directly from a survivor. And so we've put together a range of different strategies, but the most exciting is what you've been talking about. And the idea originated from one of our board members who wanted to be able to interview survivors holographically to present their stories three-dimensionally. And serendipitously, he discovered that the University of Southern California Shoah Foundation was working on just that very thing, not only the holographic piece of it, but marrying custom voice recognition software so that you can literally have a conversation with a recorded survivor. And no matter how many times I describe this and experiment with different words to use, I uniformly find that our visitors are amazed by it nonetheless. You can't really prepare for it of that when people draw a breath, when the survivor appears three-dimensionally on screen and then real-time answers their questions so that you're sitting there having a conversation.
Yeah, it sounds like something from a movie, right? It sounds like very Star Trek or any some other sci-fi. How does it work? What questions can you ask them?
You can ask absolutely any question to the survivor about their life before the war. What was it like growing up in France or Germany or wherever they were? Tell me about your family life. And then you can ask, were you in a ghetto? Were you in a concentration camp? Who from your family survived? What was it like in the camps? How did you survive? Do you believe in God? What, you know, all those kinds of questions, anything and everything, as well as some fun questions too.
What kind of fun questions can you ask them? I'm curious.
The kids often ask, and we knew that, so these questions have been asked of the recorded survivors, what's your favorite question? Could you sing a song? Can you tell a joke? Those kinds of things.
Do you like pizza? Do that?
They do occasionally do it, absolutely. And many times, to the surprise of the audience, the recorded survivor can answer it. And if not, they've been trained, the software will redirect of, oh, let's talk about something else, or I don't know about that. Can you ask me a different question?
Yeah, kind of like what Siri does, right? When you ask Siri a question and Siri doesn't know the
steroids,
answer.
On steroids, I would say.
Exactly.
It puts Siri to shame, I must confess.
Susan, why do you think it's important for people to not only be able to hear survivor stories, but be able to experience them in this way?
Yeah, we all know that most people learn best and something imprints by doing and engaging. And again, with the internet, we're also used to driving our own content and knowledge acquisition. And here you can take the conversation in a direction of things that interest you. And it feels that much more personal. We also know that pedagogically, there's no substitute for that interaction, human being to human being, for making people aware of our common humanity. And it's a wonderful supplement to the world-class exhibitions that we offer, and really a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity at this point. This is absolutely the future of the preservation of history, and thank goodness just in the time to capture this critical piece of our world history.
So the big mailing is this Sunday, Susan. What does the museum have planned?
We have a day-long set of activities. Our survivors will be on hand, and you can talk to them. I think the very most exciting thing is to experience the exhibition itself, in addition to our holographic theater where you can have a conversation with a recorded survivor. We have two other galleries for people, our Goodman Upstander Gallery and our Take a Stand lab. And in those areas, we make the connections from the history and lessons of the Holocaust, and where our visitors will learn the dangers of hatred and prejudice, and importantly, indifference, and the power of their voices and choices to affect change. We'll link that power and responsibility of our own, of our, you know, each individual to speak out to make our world a better place, to those upstanders as opposed to bystanders, who are making a difference in our world today in all different areas. It could be working for equal education access, for safe communities, for health access and a healthy environment. So we look at a range of issues in the areas of civil rights, social rights, environmental rights, and economic rights, and give people real life and life size interactives of the people who are doing these things every day. Some are famous, like Malala or John Lewis or Carly Lloyd, the Olympian soccer player, and others could be your neighbor or mine. And so we want it to feel accessible but inspirational for people. And then in the third gallery, once they're inspired, we give them the tools. How do you advocate? How do you spread the word? How do you join or found an organization? You can do things in the museum and share what you will be doing, and then you can email yourself tools to take home as well.
I'm speaking with Susan Abrams. She's CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum. She's on the line from Skokie. We're talking more about the new Take a Stand Center that opens this Sunday. As Susan's been saying, it's not just about the Holocaust, about social justice issues, about bridging all of this to contemporary social justice. And Susan, I wanted to play something for our audience here. It's a clip you all provided us that does a good job of capturing what you've been talking about. Let's take a listen to this.
How strong do you have to be a survivor, to fight on just so others can live on through your stories, the narrator that never dies? For you listening, may you always stand out and up. Continue to educate. Never think your reach is too short. You're never too young to teach. Create safe communities. Turn clay into pots of gold. Build and rebuild. Create and recreate. Fight for equality. Even when the playing field isn't even, may your individual fights become collective victories. Use your voice. Use your art. Take history to heart. Take a stand for humanity. Never be silenced. Be a survivor. Be an upstander. Be the answer.
That is spoken word poet Harold Green from Chicago, part of the new Take a Stand Center at the Illinois Holocaust Museum and Education Center. Harold is an example, I think, of how you're bridging Holocaust stories to contemporary social justice. How did you decide who went into this? How did you pick, for example, Harold?
Our education department, we partner all the time with a range of different organizations from throughout the Chicagoland area and beyond for our programs and student leadership days and teacher trainings. We regularly bring people in from around the country, but they had a relationship and it turned out to be just right.
Is there a favorite part of the center for you?
I have to say that perhaps the biggest wow, as one might expect, is with this opportunity to have a conversation with a survivor hologram, if you will. And I think that is, of course, my very favorite. But I love the opportunity to move from there into the Upstander Gallery, which is truly a visual feast. We have these story pods that are life-size, lit from behind, interactive photos, touch screens, where you can pick those upstanders and the areas that they're working on that are most exciting to you. So if you're interested in education, you can pick from five different upstanders who are working to create educational access for all. Or if you're interested in the environment, there are five others, and the visuals are stunning and life-size, and you can go as deep as you want as you touch and scroll and hear from those upstanders. So I think it's a wonderful complement and way to move from history to our world today and to excite people about engaging to do their part to make our world a better place.
That's Susan Abrams. She's CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum. She's been telling us about the new Take a Stand Center that will be opening this weekend in Skokie. We have the real-life person of one of these holographic images who's joining us as well. As we've said, part of the exhibition she's been talking about is the ability to have an interaction with a holographic image based on stories of survivors, some of them from the Chicago area. Fritzi Fritschall is with us now on the line. Fritzi, welcome to the 21st. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Fritzi, what's it like to see a holographic image of yourself?
You know, it's really difficult. I haven't accepted it yet. I sit there and I watch it and I criticize and the way I sat or whatever. I'm not sure. I sit there and keep looking at it and I'm not sure how I feel about it other okay. than the fact of what it has done and what is left behind by having this holography in the museum. As far as watching myself, it's very difficult. And it's difficult because I sat in a chair for 5 days where I was being interviewed from the time they brought me all the way back. They took me back to the time I was 3 or 4 years old and family and what we lived like. Then they took me into the darkest, darkest days of our history, which was the camp itself, Auschwitz concentration camp. They kept questioning me about that and what was it like and how did I live there and how did I survive with all the others there. And then they bring me back into today of where I live today, what I do today. And the transformation is difficult to come out of Auschwitz, because I have the tendency to put myself right back in there. I was right back in that boxcar going to Auschwitz concentration camp. I saw a mother holding a dead baby from lack of air, from lack of food, from lack of water. I saw my own grandfather die in this boxcar being taken to the concentration camp. I saw the separation. I saw my mother being taken into a different line. I saw my brothers going into a line that would go to the gas chambers. So doing all of this was very, very difficult. And at the end of the day, it was very difficult for me to deprogram myself and come into today, to today's century, to today's freedom. So it was a difficult thing to do, but I feel that I did it for the right reasons. I did it for humanity. I did it for tomorrow, for your children, your grandchildren, and your great-grandchildren, when we survivors are no longer here to tell our story. I did it so that the revisionists cannot change history. And so these are the reasons that I sat in that chair and did it for.
Fritzi, thanks for sharing that with us. We have to take a break, but if you don't mind, I'd like to, after the break, if we could talk a little bit more about that experience. Stay tuned, folks. We're talking to Fritzi Fritschall, Chicago area resident, Holocaust survivor. She's sharing how her story has now been transformed into a new holographic experience that's going to be opening this weekend at the Illinois Holocaust Museum. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. If you're just now tuning in, we've been speaking with the Illinois Holocaust Museum CEO, Susan Abrams, about the museum's new Take a Stand Center that's going to be unveiled on Sunday. Those who visit the new center, whether that's on Sunday or in the days and weeks to come, will have the opportunity to come face-to-face and digitally interact with 13 Holocaust survivors thanks to groundbreaking holographic displays and voice recognition technology. We've been talking to one of those featured survivors. Seven of them, by the way, are from the Chicago area. Fritzi Fritschall is with us. She was born in 1929 in Czechoslovakia. Fritzi, so you were just telling us about sitting in that chair for 5 days and going through the story of your whole life. You said your inclination is to go back to the camp, to Auschwitz, to those such awful, I imagine those memories that are just something that is seared into your mind. I wonder, when you were talking to the folks who were interviewing you, were there other memories that from before that you kind of maybe hadn't thought about in a while of your childhood before you were a young teenager?
Well, you know what? We all have a tendency to forget certain things and to put certain things away. And yes, I mean, when I was a teenager, I had a wonderful life. I came from a wonderful family, and my memories are absolutely great of those days. But then they take you away from those days, and they put you into the ghettos, and they put you into the concentration camps. And to live in Auschwitz, and you know, I'm often asked, and especially through all of this, what was it like in Auschwitz? How did you live? How did you survive? So I'm going to tell you that there's no way that any survivor that lived through Auschwitz can really tell you the story in one day or 2 days or in a week. It is a horrendous story. But my story is that I had help. I had help, a man when they were getting us off the boxcars, a man who was brought to Auschwitz, who was Jewish, who knew what was going on already. His job was to empty the boxcar and to get the dead people off. He walked amongst children like myself, and he kept whispering, "When you get off, you're 15, remember." So I came on as a 13-year-old and got off as a 15-year-old because of what he did. He saved my life because he knew that most children under the age of 15 would line up and go to the gas chambers, as did my two younger brothers. I stood in line with my mother. This is where the separation came. This is where the men and women were separated. This is where families were torn apart. This is where the dogs were getting at you, and the punishment, and the guns, and the confusion, and your adrenaline is such that you don't know what's happening around you. So the men and women were separated. I stood with my mother in line. And then they came and called age, and I looked at my mother and sent her into a different line. I didn't want her to be beaten there. I didn't want the dogs to get at her. So she listened to me and went into a different line. When I asked afterwards when I would see my mother, they pointed to the smoke. So the line I sent her into went directly to the gas chambers. And so I've been living with this. Would she have lived? Could she have lived if she had stayed with me? So this has been a heaviness to carry. Then I was taken out of Auschwitz, and I was put to work into a factory. The factory I was put to work in, where we did slave labor, was so horrendous. It was so much, worse. Hunger and fear and everything there was just terrible. And so I was one of 600 women doing slave labor, and I was the youngest. I was the baby. In the camps, in Auschwitz, and all over, for all of us at that point was, who will survive and who will tell the story? This is what we talked about at night. Who will survive, and will the world know? The world is standing by quietly now. We have absolutely no help in the concentration camps. We need help. Where is help? And who will believe us? Who will believe that humanity can do such horrendous things to other human beings? And so while I did slave labor with these 599 women, when the bread came at night, which was a tiny, tiny piece of bread, we were all starving. When the bread came at night, I would stand, and 599 women would give one tiny crumb of their bread and put it into the palm of my hand, because I was chosen as the one that would survive. I was chosen as the one that would live and get the story if anybody survived from those days and what was going on there. The chances for me survival were better than for others because of my youth. I was young. And so these 599 women shared their precious, precious crumbs of bread that they maybe could have survived another day on. But I took on the responsibility of being the survivor and being the messenger if I survived. And so, obviously, here I am. Mm-hmm. But it's this many years later, and yeah. I have carried this story with me all of these many years. So for many, many years, did not, would not, could not speak about it. And then when I started to, when I joined the Holocaust Museum, and when my son came to me and asked me, and said because he needed to know his mother's story. And so this is when I became the survivor this many, many years later. And so the holography that I have done is in memory of those 599 women. It is in memory of my mother, my brothers, my extended family, the 6 million that cannot speak for themselves and others that were killed during the time of the Holocaust, the 1.5 million babies that they gassed. And so while I sat in that chair and I was grilled and I was going through all of this in my mind, I was doing it for those people so that their stories can live in the future, in years to come, when we are no longer here. And so I feel that maybe through holography, when the students will see me, I'm planting a seed. I'm hoping that when they go home, tell their parents, and maybe look up a book, and maybe watch it on television, and maybe be interested enough to learn about the past, and maybe learn of what really, really happened to us during that particular time.
Fritzi, thank you so much for sharing your story again. We're speaking with Fritzi Fritschall, a Chicago area resident, who's one of the people featured in the new Illinois Holocaust Museum's Take a Stand Center that opens this weekend. The CEO of the museum has been on the line with us as well. Susan, as we hear Fritzi share her story, and we know often we hear that we should never forget, I wonder how you feel listening to this story again, why again it was so important for you to be able to have the story told and then have it told with this new technology on top of it, right? Of having, introducing this story to new generations.
Yeah. We think it's imperative to be able to tell these stories because with every year that passes from the Holocaust, there are fewer and fewer people who know somebody who was impacted. And this just brings it to people in the most personal way. We're on the phone and over radio right now, but when you look somebody in the eyes and see their expressions as they're sharing these stories, you get such a different sense again of what it means to be a human being and think about our common humanity and how could these things happen, one human being to another, and how can I prevent that from happening in the future? And I think a number of the questions that I've heard asked lend thinking in that direction. Fritzi alluded to some of those who helped her to stay alive, and that's true of all survivor stories, is that it took many, many different things for somebody to survive against all odds, but often the help of a number of different human beings. And so I think people, we hope, while learning about a devastating time, also come out with an understanding, again, of the power of their voice and their choices to affect an individual's life or even a community trajectory. So I think that's really exciting. I think that because we're able to do this in a holographic theater and with this interactive conversational component, and we're the first in the world to do this, I think it brings a broader interest base and an excitement to these stories and will enable us to touch and impact more people with this important history.
What does it mean to have someone like Fritzi play such a big role in the museum, Susan?
It is one of my greatest privileges as an employee here, a staff member, a CEO, to have the opportunity to work with Fritzi on a daily basis and to see the generosity and strength and courage that she and her fellow survivors embody. As she mentioned, she not only lived through this difficult history, but she is willing to share day in and day out, as other members of our Speakers Bureau are too, with our visitors, these experiences. And it's all about impacting the future, trying to make never again a reality. And we do it one visitor at a time. And if we can, you know, change one person's life, maybe they change another person's life and another. And I think that's part of how we improve our world.
And as you say that, as I think back to not just the story that the Fritzi has just shared now, but at the beginning of our conversation, Susan, of the whole idea of this Take a Stand Center is to talk about contemporary social justice issues. And I'm thinking in particular about when we hear stories of genocide. Fritzi, I'm thinking in particular of the news reports of the Rohingya people in Myanmar. Fritzi, when you hear those stories, I wonder what goes through your mind?
You know, we live in a very, very different kind of a world. We live in a difficult time right now. It is difficult for me as a survivor when the president does not recognize the Holocaust on Holocaust Remembrance Day. When I see what is happening around the world now, it makes me very sad and it scares me. And that is one of the reasons that we stand up and speak out, because what goes around comes around. And it scares me that we have not learned much from the past. And this is what we're trying to do. This is what all of us are trying to do, to make a better world, to have a better world, and to include all kinds of people into our world of today. Not to exclude anyone, because we all feel the same, we all bleed the same. And by presenting this, and by standing up, and by speaking out, I feel that I myself can touch some people, maybe, where they can stand up, and as Susan said, they can become the upstander and not the bystander, because the bystanders were our neighbors during that particular time. And at that point, nobody stood up and nobody spoke up out for us. So we are trying to leave a better world for our children and grandchildren.
And as you say that, Fritzi, I wonder, so much of this museum is about us learning from past generations, of us learning lessons that we can pass on to each other. What do you want us to learn about, as you said, this moment in our country and in our world?
I think what I want to learn, what I want to leave behind is we should touch each other. We should be aware of what is happening in the world today. We should stand up and speak out if we see something is wrong. We can make a better world. I alone cannot, but you and I together can leave and create a better world for our children and grandchildren. And so this is what I'm going to leave behind, and this is what I hope will happen.
Thank you for that, Fritzi. I wonder, as we think about lessons, Susan, I just want to ask about what, you know, as we think about the museum, as Fritzi's talking about passing on important lessons from one generation to another, what has Fritzi passed on to you, Susan?
I think she has passed on her optimism in spite of all that she's been through, and the sense of her strength and that commitment to making our world a better place. I know we have some students from all over our state and the Midwest, and actually as far away as Florida and Nebraska, who visit our museum. Some of them come from difficult backgrounds, and we regularly have students who come up to a survivor who's been a speaker, and they say, wow, I thought I had a heavy burden, but if you could get through what you did, I can get through what I did. So I think that's one thing that I'm struck by regularly. But I think that if somebody with Fritzi's experiences is willing to dedicate herself to making our world a better place, it only makes me want to double down and, you know, really support that and do everything in my power as well to stand up for those without a voice and to take action where I see something that could be better in our world.
That's Susan Abrams. She's CEO of the Illinois Holocaust Museum in Skokie. Susan, thank you. I want to thank Fritzi Fritschall as well, a survivor whose story is going to be chronicled in the museum's new Take a Stand Center that opens this weekend. Fritzi, Susan, thank you so much for being here with us. Thank you for taking the time to share your stories
with us.
Thank
you, and thank you for doing this, and thank you for getting our story out there.
The 21st is made possible by Kester & Bradley, LLP, providing legal services to the Urbana-Champaign community and Illinois residents since 1895. Kester & Bradley's attorneys are committed to achieving the best results for their clients. More information is available at KesterLawLLP.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Halloween's coming up early next week, but lots of people around Illinois are celebrating over the weekend, maybe dressing up as their favorite superhero or television character. But it's not just people that will be dressing up. The National Retail Federation estimates that about 20 million Americans will dress up their pets for the Halloween season, combined spending somewhere around $350 million on costumes. All kinds of fashionable costumes have been displayed up and down Illinois throughout October during dog parades and other fun events for proud pet parents. But don't panic if you haven't had one yet. There's still time. On Sunday, for instance, the Belleville Area Humane Society in Southern Illinois will host a Halloween pet parade in downtown Belleville. Joining us now to talk about that pet parade and tell us about her favorite costumes of years past is Belleville Humane Society Executive Director Katie Nelson. Jen Devine is also with us. She's a development and events manager for the Animal Care League in Oak Park. She's here to tell us about an event the league sponsored earlier in October, a bunny spa day and a Halloween-themed dress-up. Katie, Jen, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Jen, I feel like the first question we have to ask is, what is a bunny spa day?
That's a great question. So we do these about twice a year. We house at Animal Care League. We have dogs, cats, and bunnies at all times available for adoption. So to kind of feature some of our bunnies and to, you know, talk mostly about proper bunny care and nutrition. It's a hot topic. They come in, they get free nail trims, they get some brushing done, and then really exciting, it's always a theme. So this year in the fall, we decided to do a Halloween shoot. So bunnies came in dressed up, you know, in witch hats and all sorts of different things. So it's a fun event all around for educational, but then also, you know, a $10 donation for a great photo to help out our shelter bunnies as well.
We've been asking, by the way, our listeners to tweet pictures of their pets. So tweet them to 21STShow if you have pictures of your, whether they're rabbits or dogs. So did you get a lot of bunnies for that spa day, Jen?
We did. I would say we had at least 30 bunnies come through, and then we had some of our adoptable bunnies over there as well. We even had two guinea pigs join in on the photo shoot, so that was a lot of fun as well to see.
Do guinea pigs get along with bunny rabbits? Were they in separate areas?
I think they could possibly get along if it was the right fit. But we have a small animal room here, but they're housed separately.
And did people bring their own costumes for the animals, or did you guys have some costumes as well? Like, is it sort of like a photo booth where they had different outfits you could put on?
Yeah, it was a little bit of both. We definitely had some cute costumes that we supplied, just in case anyone did not come with any. And of course, the most important thing is we don't want to stress any of the animals out. So some bunnies are more accepting of a costume than others. So it was just kind of based on each bunny's temperament. But people brought some of their buns dressed up. And then if they didn't have anything, we had stuff to supply for them as well.
How can you tell when a bunny doesn't want to be dressed up?
A lot of times, so there's very subtle signs of bunny stress. A lot of times they'll kind of crouch their prey animals, so their natural reaction is to hide if they can and make themselves look as small as possible. So they'll kind of like squeeze in their body into each other, not make eye contact and things like that. And you can just tell. And if they're really stressed out, they will nip or growl and do things like that.
Okay, so they'll be pretty clear about that.
Yeah.
Katie Nelson is with us as well, Executive Director of the Belleville Area Humane Society. Katie, for your pet parade, can you tell us a little bit about what the pet parade is that's happening on Sunday?
So this is the fifth annual Halloween pet parade, and we will begin lining up at the Associated Bank in 100 East Washington in Belleville, Illinois. And the parade begins at 1 o'clock and will go in a square route in downtown Belleville and end at 2. And then from 2 to 4, we have a really fun street fest block party that is hosted by 7 Sushi Restaurant in downtown Belleville. The event is family friendly. It will be a really good time for folks bringing out dogs to, you know, dress them up and have We have an adoption booth. We have music, prizes, local vendors, animal vendors specifically, and fun activities for kids.
As you said, Katie, you've been doing this for a couple of years now. What are your favorite pet costumes you've seen?
I love the group costumes. I think it's really neat when the family of dog owners do some sort of costume with their pet. So last year I saw sort of this this hippie duo. So it was actually a standard poodle that was tie-dyed, and the owner had full-on hippie garb, and it was just a really creative costume, the way that he did a DIY type you know, painting of the dog, and his own costume, of course, was thrown together very creatively. So that was probably one of my favorites from last year. Another one was a Ghostbuster group. So they had the dogs, and then his wife and daughter, part of the Ghostbuster costume, which was really cute.
Was it the girl Ghostbusters, or was it the old school boy Ghostbusters?
Old school boy Ghostbusters.
Okay.
And it was really darling. Honestly, we see the gamut. We see, you know, a lot of DIY costumes or just a little Halloween touch, and then we see people who are, you know, completely transformed with face painting and wigs, and the dogs always are very, very tolerant of this, which amazes me year after year to see dogs comply with being dressed up, but it's very cute.
And is it just dogs, or do you have other pets that are on parade too?
So just the dogs for the parade, but we do have an adoption booth for our street fest where we plan to have kittens. So, just for the nature of being outside, dogs and cats are probably the most appropriate, or at least kittens, for this event. And those are the two animals that we adopt through our Humane Society, our dogs and cats.
And now, I know entry for the pet parade is $10. Where do those proceeds go?
So at the Belvoir Humane Society, we when we intake a dog or cat, we do all of their vaccinations. Rabies, if, for example, a dog turns up to be heartworm positive after their test, we do pay for that treatment, the spay neuter. So medical is a huge component of the proceeds for this parade and other fundraisers. In addition to that, we have a brick and mortar shelter here, so we do have some operational costs also, in addition to taking care of our animals here. So it all goes back to the organization. We are 100% donor funded, no government support, so every dollar does count.
And as we're listening to Katie describe this, Jen, I wonder if the Bunny Spa also, if different organizations that work with animals or animal rescue use the Halloween parades as a good fundraising opportunity also. Jen, do you guys do that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We actually are doing this upcoming Sunday, we're doing a trick-or-treat parade event as well for a $10 admission. So, yeah, absolutely. And same thing with Bunny Spa Day. The $10 donations for the photo, that really helps out. And we also sell, you know, hay and other merchandise there. It all really does. We are also 100% donor funded. So it's absolutely a great fundraising opportunity, and also just to get our name out there in the community.
And so the trick-or-treating that you're doing this weekend, is that for dogs or for people?
It's for dogs. So we're actually doing, they're going to go around to different stations, and each station is going to have them do a different trick, like sit, stay, speak. And as soon as they do that, they'll get a little goodie bag treat to go home with. So we have some local vendors coming out for that. We'll have music and good stuff like that, too.
Oh, great. So let me ask you guys, and both of you can weigh in here. I feel like millions, as we've talked about, millions of people dress their pets up for Halloween. They spend tons of money every year to do so. Jen, let me start with you. Why do you think people, I think this is a uniquely American phenomenon, to dress up our dogs and cats in goofy costumes?
Why do you, I think, well, it's fun, it's funny. And, you know, for the animals that don't mind it, it's a really good bonding experience to be able to do that with your pet, your companion. You know, a lot of, you know, these days everyone treats their animals like they're their children. And so it's just an extended part of the family that they can enjoy in on the fun with the kids and the whole family as well.
Katie, what do you think?
Dogs are resilient and highly tolerant of the things that people do to them. And just like Jen said, it's fun for people to do together with their animals. And while it might not be our most profitable fundraiser, it's a really fun community event where people come out and get to know each other, whether it be volunteers of the Humane Society or community members. But people really bond over dogs. So I think that the Halloween, the dressing up of the animals is a really fun and creative component to add to community bonding and togetherness in support of a Humane Society or House Rabbit Society or, you know, any animal welfare organization.
So I feel like Captain America and Wonder Woman are going to be really hot this year. Do you notice any trends in the animal world? Are there going to be a lot of Wonder Woman bunnies? What do you guys think?
Yeah, I'm feeling a big Game of Thrones theme this year. Some reporters have asked me questions about if we, as a Humane Society, have seen any increase in the husky breed, for example, coming through here because of the wolf or something in that show. And while we haven't, I think that any popular show would, you know, then increase in a trending costume based on what's popular on Netflix or HBO, for example. But I really like the family costumes the best because it just shows so much creative thought that goes into dressing up, not only, you know, in conjunction with your family members, but then one, two, or three dogs as well. So that's
Katie,
always very entertaining.
Yeah. Katie, do you have any pets?
I do. I have three dogs. I have Scout, Boots, and Ruru. And Ruru is a rescue, and then Scout and Boots are border collies.
And are you going to dress them up?
Well, I'm probably going to do a little bit more this day with our shelter dogs. Unfortunately, and my husband teases me about this often, our dogs don't always come to events with us because we're promoting shelter dogs with Adopt Me vests on and making sure that people know that they're available for adoption and to join their household. So I think that our dogs have other plans that day to hopefully stay with my brother-in-law, but my husband will be there volunteering and walking a shelter dog for us, which I greatly appreciate.
Jennifer, what about you? Do you have any pets? Are you going to dress them up?
I do. Well, I have two cats. Their names are Pepsi and Coke, and they are also rescues. I actually fostered them and then foster failed, as they call it, because I adopted them. So I will attempt to dress them up as I do every year, and we'll see how it goes. It's sometimes it goes okay, sometimes not. So we'll see.
Do you dress them up as Pepsi and Coke?
Actually, I did get one of Coke in a Coca-Cola box once, so that was pretty funny. But yeah.
Okay. Again, how much they tolerate. Well, ladies, thank you for joining me to talk about Halloween pet costumes, a little bit of events that are going on, some good fundraisers for the Humane Society. We'll tweet out those links if folks are in the Belleville area and want to go to the pet parade this weekend, as well as Jen's events in the Chicago area. Ladies, thanks for being with me. Happy Halloween.
Thank you. You too.
That's all the time we have for today. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. If you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Tell her, ask NPR One to play The 21st. All of those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us. If you want to send us an email, if you'd like to leave us a voicemail, if you'd like to figure out all of our social media handles, you can just remember our website. That's 21stshow.org. Speaking of social media, if you follow us on Twitter, our handle is 21stshow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. On our Facebook page, search for The 21st to like us. You can also comment on what we're working on. You can see the things we're reading. You can post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. We're produced by Robin Lynn, Alan Montecilio, and Bob Hawley. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Thanks to the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help. And special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're broadcasting today from the Medill Graduate School of Journalism in downtown Chicago. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.